Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. Monique W. Morris. Morris has been working in the area of education, civil rights, and social justice for over 20 years. She is co-founder of the National Black Women's Justice Institute, and she is an advisory board member for Global Girl Media of Oakland, California. She is also a regular contributor to Ebony.com. She recently published a groundbreaking book called Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. It was released in March of this year by the New Press. I'm speaking to Dr. Morris by phone from her home in the San Francisco Bay Area. Monique Morris, welcome to Out of Bounds. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, we've been hearing in the news for many years about the plight of young black men like Trayvon Martin, but your book made it so clear to me that young black women have been totally invisible in all these stories. Now, is that the reason why you decided to write up this and do this study?
Yes. You know, for a long time I was aware of the public erasure of black girls' experiences and found it deeply problematic. In 2012, I wrote a more academic piece that looked at the school-to-prison pipeline and where we might find black girls in that conversation. And that was really the beginning of my, I guess, public engagement around this issue. But really, I was aware that there were educational factors contributing to the criminalization and push out of black girls for some time. You know, beginning with my interactions with girls who had been in contact with the criminal and juvenile legal systems, and my work with them, you know, demonstrated and revealed really that, you know, these girls who were in contact with the juvenile legal system were also girls who had experienced school push out, who were not completing school, who had extreme victimization and exploitation histories that were being under-examined and not really included in our public discussions about risk and safety.
Yeah. Your book is absolutely fascinating. It was so eye-opening for me. Now you talk a lot about institutionalized classism, racism, of course, and it triggers a total misreading of black girls' behavior. Talk to us a little bit about that. They're constantly labeled troublemakers because of their behavior.
Yeah, and I'm glad you are bringing that up. In much of our academic spaces or even in our public conversations about identity, we tend to talk about black people as if they are a monolith. And what has happened is when we talk about black people or racial justice on a more positive note, we tend to masculinize that experience and focus primarily on men and boys. And when we talk about gender identity and we talk about what's happening with women and girls, we tend to default to a broader narrative that still erases the conditions of girls and young women who are experiencing both racial oppression and gender oppression, and, as I focus in on this book, the socioeconomic conditions that exacerbate each of those conditions, and you know, the sexual identities that also, you know, fit in there and inform the way that we respond to girls, particularly black girls. And so, you know, what I talk about is the way in which these identities interact with each other. It's related to intersectionality, which is a term that was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw to help us better understand how these multiple identities then come together to inform how we read behaviors and how we understand the relationships between these girls and structures and systems. So often, you know, the identity of the black femininity has been misunderstood according to, you know, sort of our public misperception and misreading. And that misreading is rooted in historically centered racial stereotypes that have also been gendered, mm-hmm. which presents black girls and women as hypersexual or loud and sassy or defiant in the school setting, and that these conditions have led adults in these spaces to respond to these behaviors with punishment and criminalization. And so that's the core piece around identity that I explore as we look then at how it has come to manifest in the schools when there is the absence of a full continuum of responses that are not punitive and criminalizing. You know, so what we have is, you know, that, and I root this in a historical context because I think it's important for us to understand that the legacy of slavery and segregated opportunity has really socialized punishment and discipline as a way to respond to black girls who rebel against normative ideas about what is proper feminine behavior. So anything that steps into the line of what might be read as defiant or loud and combative. is then responded to with a greater degree of harshness.
Yeah, and you know what is, it was so astounding to me while I was reading your book and thinking just about the culture at large is, you know, for so many years, all of us in the feminist movement were trying to get women to be more assertive and speak up and speak for themselves. And we, you know, you bring up the fact that there's still this normative guideline that, you know, middle-class, heterosexual, white femininity is supposed to be the median.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, one of the girls that I interviewed for the book, she referred to herself as just being outspoken. And then she said, you know, adults are always telling us, you know, to voice our opinions, but then when we voice our opinions, we're going to get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And she framed it as irritating. I think it's much more harmful than just being irritating.
Uh-huh. Right? I remember that story, Monique, in your book.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think what we have done, I mean, is one, we've got to recognize that Black girls in particular have long been cast as defiant, but we have not publicly examined it. There have been Black feminist scholars like bell hooks who have helped us situate the reading of Black femininity along these, you know, stereotypical renderings to, you know, help us develop what she refers to as an oppositional gaze, right? A gaze to combat the misreadings. But at the same time, you know, what we're doing with young girls is sending them mixed messages about how we celebrate their femininity and, you know, don't allow them the opportunity to fully explore and develop their own construct of gender identity. That is just deeply problematic. And so, you know, for that reason, you know, it's really important for us to talk about school pushout, important for us to talk about school to confinement pathways in a way that allows for us and the girls that we're talking about to develop new frameworks and new opportunities, really, to counter this very harmful and linear narrative about their development.
Yeah. And your book is so articulate in telling us what our problems are with the way we're dealing with kids in school, especially Black girls. Now you bring up a young woman from the historical culture who didn't fit the norm and was totally written out of history. Talk about Claudette Colvin.
Yeah, you know, Claudette Colvin is still alive, and I love that she is still alive and still, you know, engaged in conversations about justice. I thought it was important to bring her story into this narrative about school pushout and about erasure of Black girl voices, because before there was Rosa Parks, there was a 15-year-old, dark-skinned Black girl who refused to give up her seat and who stood against what she understood to be, you know, an oppressive structure. And because she didn't fit, you know, what was, I guess, considered by many to be an appropriate representation of Black femininity, in many ways, she was erased from our public consciousness around civil rights and social justice in this country. And I include her in this book and her ability to stand against oppression and as an example of how Black girls have long been a part of constructing, you know, the argument for justice in this nation, and yet not acknowledged for it. And even when we do include, especially in our academic spaces and in our learning spaces, a recognition of this fight for equity and justice in society, we still don't honor the ways in which Black girls have been at the center of these conversations. Brown versus Board of Education, we tend to think about the very brilliant Thurgood Marshall and his legal team, forgetting that it was about Linda Brown, a little Black girl who was, you know, at the center of the case, and many other Black girls who, you know, voices and whose energy has fueled, you know, our quest for justice, particularly with respect to attaining a quality education. And education, you know, I think it's important to say, education is a critical protective factor against contact with the juvenile and criminal legal system. And this book is really about exploring how we interrupt those pathways to confinement for Black girls who are still disproportionately represented among girls who are in detention facilities, in residential placements, and in any form of, you know, youth prisons and jails that exist in this country, as well as the informal ways in which black girls and other girls are impacted by confinement, the home-based probation, the surveillance that occurs with the GPS monitoring, that, you know, there are many ways in which we have criminalized young people and many ways in which we have failed to actually respond to the root causes of their misbehavior. And that is really, you know, what I want to get to. We know that girls with an education are less likely to be in contact with the juvenile legal system. So let's find ways to keep our girls in school.
Oh, absolutely. It behooves all of us to want that for our whole culture, you know. Now you talk about the fact that a lot of black girls live in poverty. About 25% of black women live in poverty, single mothers. And often these girls attend high poverty schools where the expectation is that they will remain poor and they are sort of granted permission to fail. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, you know, I think it's when we talk about school pushout, and one thing I'll say is school pushout is really a way that advocates have pushed back against the term dropout. And, you know, dropout has been a term that has been circulating, you know, in our public spaces for quite a long time, really sort of, you know, making it appear that this is the decision of a child not to complete school. And so what pushout does is talk more explicitly about the ways in which the structures in our learning spaces are actually facilitating young people not completing school, turning them away from school, and finding ways to get them removed from school. When we talk about what's occurring in many of the high-poverty, low-performing schools, what I'm drawing attention to is the way in which two things are occurring. One is the way in which some educators may be responding to the behaviors of black girls in a way that facilitates their lack of engagement in the course material and the learning, really accepting an underachievement. And that is something that many educators might not even know that they're doing. And for that reason, I talk a bit in this book about implicit bias and the ways in which some of the ways in which we interact with young people or with other people who are different from our own in-group may even be inconsistent with our stated beliefs about that particular group. So many folks will say, I treat all my students the same. I just want to make sure everybody has an equal opportunity. And yet when they actually respond to various students, implicitly they are responding to the stereotypes and biases that they have learned and absorbed over time about that group. And so we see black girls granted permission not to perform at a higher level or written off as underperforming when, in fact, there are other things at play, or not given other opportunities that students who are not black girls are also are given to participate in their own learning and in the development of a learning culture in the classroom that is conducive to student achievement. The second piece I want to talk about with the low-performing, high-poverty schools is that educators and school leaders who are more likely to believe that punishment is the appropriate response to negative student behavior in these spaces are more likely, obviously, to use the exclusionary discipline, the suspensions, the expulsions, the corporal punishment, for example, in response to negative student behavior, as opposed to other practices, the restorative engagement, mindfulness, or empathic discipline practices that actually do respond to root causes and can get young people to refocus on what it is that they're there to do, which is to learn, as opposed to just saying, get out of the school, you don't belong here. And so, you know, this is largely a critique of the zero tolerance policies that have been put in place that push children out of school, but it's also about the things, even in those spaces where there are not zero tolerance policies, that lead adults to make decisions about young people based upon whether we perceive them as docile or whether we perceive them as appropriate for the learning environment, as opposed to really thinking about ways to get them centered so that they can learn and be active in class.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Monique W. Morris. We're talking about her groundbreaking book called Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. It was released just this year by the New Press. Now, let's talk about the zero tolerance policy in many schools. It does seem to affect black girls more, you know, no doubt because of racism and preconceived notions about behavior. But it feels like schools are becoming militarized, and who wouldn't revolt against that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's one thing that I do say and that I think is important here is that all children have been impacted by the implementation of zero tolerance policy, that there have been numerous studies now that critique this practice and have established that it is not particularly useful when we're talking about responding to negative student behavior and really dealing with the root causes. And I try to include narratives in the book from the girls who are disproportionately impacted by these policies to demonstrate that just removing a child from a school does not address the conflict. It really does not. What they do is they hold on to it, they bring it into community, and often bring it back to school. Mm-hmm. And so there have to be other ways, you know, of old, really. I mean, for a long time, it's not that children have just started to fight, right? Children have not just started to develop conflict. These things have always been in place, but there were other ways to respond to it. You know, following the Gun-Free School Act, black girls became the fastest growing population to experience school suspensions and expulsions. And, you know, this growing rate of involvement with school discipline is, I say, both a function of their behaviors being responded to with a greater degree of punishment, as well as the increasing absence of alternatives when children get in trouble and when we're trying to move forward with the lesson in schools. And I don't think that it's been deliberate, but there have absolutely been egregious cases of using zero tolerance policies to respond to behaviors that absolutely do not pose a threat to public safety. Mm-hmm. We have girls as young as 6 years old, black girls as young as 6 years old, being placed in handcuffs and arrested for having tantrums in their schools, in their classrooms. We have a girl who was placed in handcuffs and placed under the stairs just recently, in the Midwest, for taking candy from her teacher's desk. And the adult's response was, "I wanted to teach her a lesson." What lesson?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, there are ways in which we have, as a culture, accepted that we should be harsh and engage punishment as opposed to really try to reconnect with young people, which is what they're asking for, to address what it is that they need in their lives to be active, safe students. Yeah. And, you know, for that reason, I talk about how important it is that we not move into school spaces saying that we need to implement safety. Safety is not something that can be implemented. It's something that has to be co-constructed. That means you have to do it in partnership with the people who we intend to keep safe. What do kids need to feel safe? We have to have conversations with them about that because our adult perception about what safety looks like may be different, especially for girls, black girls, Latina girls, Native American girls who are experiencing elevated rates of risk and victimization. The safety is different. And so the ways that we respond to that may not necessarily be the way that we think is appropriate.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
So having more law enforcement in school or having a metal detector or having some of these other, you know, structures and instruments of surveillance may not necessarily be our answer, is what I'm suggesting.
You know what I found really illuminating in your book was the fact that so many of the girls that you interviewed and talked to said that there was a simple way for them to feel safer and better in schools, to have a caring teacher. Now,
exactly. Why
does that seem like such a huge hurdle?
You know, I don't know. And I have been saying to folks, it's really important for us to think that the most radical recommendation here is that we lead with love. It's not that we necessarily need to, you know, increase the spending on other instruments and other individuals. Children want a caring adult in their life. Children want to learn from an adult they believe cares about them. And if they are not able to connect with that adult, some of the new research coming out of Stanford on empathic discipline has demonstrated that, particularly for black and Latina girls, it's important to even have just one teacher in the school that this child can connect with, that can be that person for them. That ultimately, we're talking about children and what they need to grow, just as any other child needs, is love. And so when I've asked girls, what is it that you need to feel safe? How can you better respond? How could what do you think you need need to be a better performer in school. Every one of them has come back and said, well, I just need somebody on campus who cares. I need to know that there's a teacher who believes that I can do it. And they are begging for this in many of their spaces. Now, I think that most teachers do believe that they care. I think that.
Well, I would assume so too, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that most teachers enter the profession because they believe in education and they care about children. What's happening, though, is that our own frustrations with many of the conditions that facilitate harm and risk in our communities are preventing the teachers from engaging in the development of skill sets that can help them better manage their classrooms outside of having a punitive discipline response. There's got to be better teacher training on how to connect with young people. There's got to be better teacher training on implicit bias. There's got to be better structures in schools to do the kind of professional development that supports teacher well-being and healing, and so that they can really be prepared to engage in the learning process and in the teaching process, just as we expect the students to be there as well.
Yeah.
You know, teachers have to feel supported in their workplace also. I'm an educator. I'm married to an educator. I understand the challenges there, and I understand, you know, that the administrators have their own set of challenges around performance objectives that are sometimes undermined by student misbehavior. And so there have to be a series of conversations about how we construct new climates, how we co-construct new learning spaces and climates that really do allow for young people to play a more active role in responding and setting the norms in the schools. And also, really, to get educators to understand that, you know, as some of the teachers say in this book, that part of their job is to do this, that there has been this way in which some teachers have come to divorce themselves from understanding that as a teacher, they are also a mentor. As a teacher, they are also the caring adult in school. They're not just there to teach the course curriculum and the lesson plan and then leave. That part of what they have to do when they're seeking to connect with young people is to establish that relationship. And through that relationship, young people learn. I knew that from all of my caring adult teachers, and, you know, the most effective teachers understand that you've got to build relationships with students,
and that is
what we need to begin to reiterate in our preparation programs.
Yeah, you know, I think about teachers and administrators and what a challenge it is, because so many, especially black girls with the challenges that they have in so many of their communities. The problem of self-esteem. Now, how does an education system deal with that? It's systemic in many families. And
well, it's interesting because black girls have a very high self-esteem, actually, when you test them on their, like, on certain aspects. So they have very high physical self-esteem. They love themselves.
Mm-hmm. You talk about that. Yep.
And we see it demonstrated in ways that I think are actually very positive and resilient and often read as defiant. Okay?
Yes.
And also, though, they lack confidence in many spaces when it does come to academic performance, and that's something that we have to work on, particularly given how much that aligns with the stereotypes about the attributes of black femininity and mm-hmm. how it is presented publicly, how it is consumed by industry, you know, in ways that are harmful to black girls' identity. But at the same time, I think what is occurring around this idea of how they might manifest their esteem in class is really to have affirming spaces for them, discussion groups with them, for them, by them, that really do allow them to engage their intersectional identities in ways that are helpful to their own development.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there have been growing investments around the country in men and boys of color, right? My Brother's Keeper and many other initiatives have been in place that have established groups of support in schools, in communities, for boys. And that's all been really great. And many of us have been calling for a consistent, comparable investment in girls. And I think we're beginning to see that. You know, just a few weeks ago, there was the United States of Women that was sponsored by the White House Council on Women and Girls. And there is a growing movement in many communities to establish these same spaces in schools. I was just in Los Angeles earlier this week where a young person stood up in the conversation about the book and School Pushout, and she said, okay, so what do I do? How can I take this information back to my peers to make sure that we know how we can, you know, support each other? And, you know, one of the panelists in the conversation, Nola Brantley, who runs Nola Brantley Speaks and is a very amazing advocate and spokesperson working with commercially sexually exploited youth, responded by saying, I hear you saying I'm going to start a girls group in my school. We're going to talk and we're going to engage these, you know, issues with my peers. And it was a beautiful moment because we see so many young people, so many black girls who do want to exercise leadership, who have the core skills to be leaders in community around these issues, that have yet to find an outlet and a space and an adult to help them organize that space for them to really support each other in meaningful ways.
Yeah, I think your book is going to help. I think you should make sure Michelle Obama gets a copy of your book.
I hope you guys get a copy of it.
Seriously, Monique. Now, you know what? Before we do run out of time, as I read your book, I couldn't help but wonder what your early school experiences were as a black girl.
Yeah. You know, I was always a high performer. I do identify and talk openly about my own sexual victimization history. And I think, you know, that played out in other ways. But certainly, when I look at these girls who have had experiences, I do see myself, because I know that one of the things that kept me from following a similar path that these girls have followed was that I had education, and that my mother and my grandmother were very clear about the importance of education in my life and the need for me to have it. And so I went to various schools, some of them high-performing, some of them not, early on, where I just read. I was a reader. I was a reader and a writer. Mm. And, you know, for me, it was a form of escape, and it was a way for me to understand what was happening. But I also think that there was a basic curiosity that I had that I was able to really fully develop with teachers who cared. Now, I was absolutely subjected to the differential treatment around dress code. I was absolutely treated differently with respect to how educators sometimes saw my performance, suggesting that I got help, quote unquote, on things that I did well in. And so, you know, I think that there are ways, absolutely, that even the high-performing girls have to overcome the stigma of, you know, racial bias and gender bias in their own spaces. And I think that having the tools that I had to be able to, you know, articulate when I was feeling I was wronged, asking core questions and not backing down, and having an adult, you know, my mother, as a chief advocate with me these spaces, made all the difference in the world. You know, in high school, I went to a high-performing school in San Francisco that my daughter now attends, and I love the school because I think what it has done for me is, while it is absolutely challenging on a host of levels, what it did was it allowed for me to structure my own critique and hone my own voice and skill set around examining issues of justice and equity. That kind of freedom, that kind of ability to ask questions, to critically engage, to challenge authority without it being seen as an affront to their status, was critical to my development and my ability to do what I do today. And so I jokingly say that many of the schools that teach kids how to run things, right, how to run businesses, how to run organizations, how to be themselves, their whole selves in their learning space, those are the places where kids develop the kind of curiosity and capacity to be leaders in our communities. And so what we want to do is find ways to replicate that basic idea that children are whole people, and that we can come in and work with them in their wholeness to develop who they will be. Instead of shutting it down, we develop it. And it's a simple shift in consciousness.
Yeah. We're almost out of time. Can you give contact information, website, where people can get your book, talk to you if they want to? Yeah.
Sure. The book is available through all the major booksellers and online. My website is MoniqueWMorris.com. My organization is the National Black Women's Justice Institute, and that's nbwji.org.
Well, Monique Morris, thank you so much for joining us. What an important book, and I'm so glad you wrote it. I'm sure it's going to make a difference in our culture. Again, the book is called Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. Thank you, Monique Morris, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.